Welcome back to the program. Yeats wrote of a time when the best lacked all conviction, when the worst were full of passion and intensity. He might have been writing about today. As it is certainly true that the falcon cannot hear the falconer, that things fall apart, that the center cannot hold, and that mere anarchy seems loosed upon the world. But how do we get out of this? How do we move on? The answer may lie in the old adage that the only way to predict the future is to create it. That is, to create a whole new way of looking at the world. That's what we're going to talk about today with my guest, Frances Moore LePage. She's the author of 17 books, including the famed Diet for a Small Planet, which now has 3 million copies in print. She is the co-founder of three organizations, including Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and more recently, the Small Planet Institute. She's the recipient of numerous awards, and it is my pleasure to welcome Frances Moore LePage back to this program to talk about her newest work, EcoMind, changing the way we think to create the world we want. Frances Moore LePage, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you. What a marvelous introduction. I loved your framing of this because it's exactly how I feel about it, but hadn't thought of that way of saying it, so thank you.
And in fact, what you talk about is that we do need to find new ways of looking at the world because in many ways, you argue, the problems we face today are a function not only of the problems themselves, but how we approach them, how we frame them, that is in many ways contributing and exacerbating the existing problems.
Absolutely. And this insight actually has been growing in me for decades because it started with Diet for a Small Planet, which you kindly mentioned. And there I was, you know, sitting in the San Francisco Bay Area, looking out actually at the bay, and putting the numbers together and realizing that, wait a minute, while the experts are telling us that we've hit the limits of the earth to feed us, that actually there's more than enough food in the world to make us chubby, and we're creating the scarcity, the experience of scarcity amidst plenty. And this has become even more true today.
And a lot of this is the what you talk about is the power of context, really, that we need to look at things in a fundamentally different way.
Well, this is the idea of the eco mind. On one hand, it is so simple. It is thinking, okay, we're like other organisms in the environment, in the larger ecology, and we know now, this is what we've been learning for decades through the science of ecology, that everything is shaped moment to moment by everything else in its context. And what shows up, what genes get expressed, largely depend on, you know, just what the environment is. If you think about, you know, what a plant needs, what an animal needs to thrive, it's a certain environmental stimuli, right? Well, the same is true for human beings. And this is the theme of the book, of this eco mind, is saying, okay, what do we now know? What do we now know through our long history, through lab experiments in which we've been the guinea pigs? What do we know about what brings out the best in us and what brings out the worst in us? And that really, that's a thread that runs through the book, and I humbly offer three conditions that seem to be pretty obvious to bring out the worst, and knowing that, then we can see how to reverse those conditions to bring out the best. And so we have to get rid of this notion that somehow shed this notion that we are, you know, we come full-formed, we're just these little individual separate entities doing our thing, and they're the good ones and the bad ones, and we just got to get rid of the bad ones. That's not working. And see that, in fact, what shows up in most of us, since we now know from history and, as I say, anthropology, and our lab experiments, that most of us can behave very, very badly in the wrong circumstances, not just a handful, not just a few. And the reverse is also true. So it's really, that's a theme that runs through the book, but the book is, of course, full of stories about how that is playing out.
The phrase that comes to mind over and over again in looking at this is the phrase human nature and what that really means.
Right. And I ask us in EcoMind, I ask us to drop the debate about the goodness of human nature. Are we good or are we bad? And to talk about the goodness in human nature, and that's not just a semantic flip. The goodness in human nature, my favorite chapter in the book, in a way, is about that. It's exploring. I argue that we have just the qualities, just I call them our soft-wired qualities for empathy and cooperation. These are now proven through neuroscience, and our need to be doers, not just couch potatoes and whiners. You know, we have the qualities. So it's we have the goodness in us. The question is, to repeat, you know, how I began, it's what kind of environment, what kind of social and, of course, physical in terms of nutritional and all those things, what kind of environment do we need to bring out those qualities because they're in us? So let's stop debating the goodness of, you know, whether we're good or bad and recognize that we can be both and we can be either, in other words. And it depends on the decisions that we make. And really the argument of the book is that somehow the problem is we've fallen for this, what I call this mental map, this map of scarcity, this lack. We see the world through the lens of lack. There's not enough goods and there's not enough goodness. And the goodness part, of course, is about human nature, but there's not enough food, there's not enough energy, and there's not enough goodness in us. And I argue that from that lens, that filter, then that is what we actually create. We create that, I say that seeing, it's not seeing, it's believing. Believing is seeing. And if we believe in that lack of goods and goodness, then we then create that.
These are what you call the seven thought traps that you've laid out.
Right. Well, the thought traps are a way to get at this larger mental map. And so, for example, I talk in the beginning of the book about the thought trap that dawned on me, you know, those years ago when I was writing Diet for a Small Planet, the thought trap, we've hit the limits of a finite Earth, you know. That is pretty scary. And that is the scarcity mind. And what the opposite of that is the eco mind, that is the mind of possibility, because actually, if you think of that simple phrase, we've hit the limits of a finite Earth. Well, how could that be? I mean, the sun supplies us 15,000 times a daily dose of energy that we're currently, compared to what we're currently using in fossil fuel. Estimates are that we waste in this economy, we waste from 55% to up to 87%. I've seen solid science, you know, with both of those numbers, we waste that much, that huge percentage of energy in the U.S., right? So how can we say we've hit the limits? What we've done is that we've so perversely aligned our economy with our nature, human nature, and the nature of nature, with the laws of nature, that we end up creating waste and destruction. So that's a very different frame than saying somehow we've hit nature's limits. It's not nature that is skimpy and ungiving of what we need. It's that from the premise of scarcity, we are actually so malaligned with the laws of nature that we're destroying more than we're benefiting.
One of the things you touch on is the importance of kind of the scientific mind and understanding this from a scientific perspective.
I think this science of ecology, sometimes I think of it like the Copernican Revolution, that it took a long time after we understood that, you know, that we weren't the center of things, that the sun was. It took a long time for that to seep in. And I feel that we're in that moment now, and it's touching every part, including Occupy Wall Street, including the deep, deep inequalities we're suffering from, where we have half of our children now will be on food stamps at some point in their childhood. These are symptoms of that we haven't incorporated into our lives, into how we see ourselves, this new understanding of the world through the lens of ecology, how everything is connected to all else. And, you know, the very simple thing, right, that we have a carbon cycle in the atmosphere, and if we put too much in, more than we're absorbing, then we're heating the planet. That's a way of seeing everything being connected to all else. And it means down to the science of now the brain. You know, you talk about aligning with science is so critical in the book. Well, one of the most exciting discoveries in the 1990s that I talk about in the book is the discovery of mirror neurons. So this is another way to talk about the connectedness of all, that mirror neurons mean that as we're observing anyone else, that there are actually neurons in our own brains that are firing as if we were taking that action. So we are constantly kind of walking in each other's shoes, whether we like it or not. So we are shaping one another. So our actions and even our attitudes are infectious. And therefore, this means to me that we each have vastly more power than we thought we did. In this connected world of the eco mind, this idea that everything is continuously created moment to moment through the interactions of all else, which is exactly what the physiologists, the ecologists are telling us, then no one is utterly powerless. And I'd love to quote my friend, physicist in Germany, Hans-Peter Dürer. He says to me, Francis, in this understanding of life, which we now are embracing in science, there are no parts. There are only participants. So even our non-actions have consequences in this way of seeing life.
Are you seeing that the younger generation today has a much firmer grasp of this sense of empathy and cooperation?
Yes, very much so. And that's why, you know, in my own work, I'm so thrilled to be working with young people. And I get a greater response, I would say, on average from young people. And I'm working to make sure that my work gets as much as I can, you know, influence it, gets used in college classes. This morning I'm going to do a Skype class with Mount Holyoke College where they're using EcoMind so that I can actually interact directly in that connectedness frame with these young people. But I think they, partly because of all sorts of changes, of course, the obvious being our greater communication and the you know, that we all have a chance to see the consequences of our actions much more in an interconnected world through the Internet and other communications technologies that we did not have before. So, and there are many other influences. I mean, just the obvious one, that this mindset of scarcity that tells us that we don't have the goodness in us to actually, we don't have the capacities to come together to deliberate over our common future in a democratic process. We're seeing that assumption is just false, and it's not working. We then turn over our fate to a marketplace that ends up so concentrating wealth that we have what I call privately held government, and that's what I think is being protested in the streets of the world, including Boston, where I live, and Wall Street, of course, at the center. But I think part of what young people are saying now is this is not working. This is not working because it's excluding me, and I am a person of dignity and need to have a voice.
One of the ironies in this that you essentially talk about is that we are creating a world through these mental maps that we have, that we're creating a world that we wouldn't necessarily choose to live in.
Right. That is the question, my leading question of my life. Why are we together creating a world that not one of us as individuals would choose? Because I'm sure you'd agree with me. You don't know anyone who gets up in the morning and says, it's a great idea, you know, that almost a billion people are going hungry. It's a great idea that Americans' children are, you know, so many of them now are in poverty and relying on food stamps. So just to pick two horrors, but not to mention the heating of our planet. So, yes, that's the big question, and that comes back to the whole point of this book is to help people see that there is much greater possibility than we ever imagined if we can shift from this presumption of scarcity of goods and goodness. And I really break this down. This is not just I just want to underscore to the listeners that this is not just a big picture book. This is in concrete stories and surprising facts that once you shift from that frame and bring and trust ourselves that we can come together, that our problems are solvable. And so I call myself not a pessimist or an optimist, but a possibilist, because, you know, I have stories in there just to grab one out of the air, sort of, you know, about what's possible when you shift from the scarcity mode on the whole challenge of deforestation today, which is huge. It's huge from, you know, from a livelihood point of view of people dependent on them. It's huge from the loss of biodiversity. It's a huge issue because of the impact of deforestation on the heating of our planet. All those things. Well, in India, there are now 10 million households, 10 million households at the village level involved in a democratic process, a village, you know, very personal face-to-face of guarding, taking care of, protecting, reestablishing healthy forests. And so India is one of the few countries in the world in which forest is actually expanding. We could jump to a country like Brazil, which is a very capitalist country. You know, its economy is very market-driven, but they have taken seriously anti-poverty. So they have reduced poverty anywhere from, depending on what measure you're using, from 25 to 40% in less than a decade. So this is all possible if we shift from this view, oh, there's not enough, we can't possibly end hunger, or we can't possibly reduce poverty, or we can't possibly fight deforestation because the forces of, you know, the big agribusiness industries and are too big and tearing down the forest, you know. So this is the theme of the book, is really about possibility, when we can see a place for ourselves in making significant change.
Of course, making this significant change implies a certain amount of power. Talk about how power needs to be dispersed within this framework.
Well, let me go back to the beginning of the interview where we talked about this eco-mind idea that we like human, you know, we like every part of nature. We respond to our environment. So I posit that there are three conditions that have proven, and I'd love to engage with people who read the book on this, but it seems like there are three that bring out the worst in us. That's concentrated power, that is secrecy. We don't do well when things are secret, and the blaming culture like we have today. Oh, it's the Tea Party. Oh, it's Obama. Oh, it's, you know, somebody else. So those three conditions. So power to me is in understanding, first of all, that we all are shaped by our environment, and then working to create the opposite of those conditions. I just gave that one example about India, that instead of having it centered in centralized patrol of the forest to try to keep out people who are destroying it, that local people were empowered to create their own forest management groups, and it's working. So the dispersion of power, and that means everything in our society from getting money out of politics, and now we have a model for how that can work, an approach of how that can work. I talk about the state of Maine, for example, where almost 85% of legislators have run without using corporate money, and they're free, therefore, to listen to the citizens. And people like waitresses, my hero Deb Simpson, can run and win, run for the state legislature and win. So the dispersion of power is everything from getting money out of the driver's seat in our political system, and it means stepping up in every dimension of life. One of the stories that I love to tell is about a very successful high school, public high school, low-income area in Ohio, where the principal believes in this kind of dispersion of power and engaging young people to get a sense of their own power. So he gradually has transferred more and more responsibility to students so that they now even sit on a committee that has equal power to other, you know, to teachers in choosing faculty when new faculty are hired. And as a result of their empowerment, instead of 10% going on, or 20%, I forget, but a low percentage going to college, now, after a decade of this approach, 70% are going on to college. They've experienced power, and this is true in every dimension of life. But it's the dispersion of power, whether we're talking about getting money out of politics, whether it's local groups that are taking on the protection of forests, or whether it's kids in school that are empowering, working with their administration to have a voice in their own schools. So this is what I'm saying brings out the best in us, and as long as it is transparent, because secrecy brings out, as we saw on Wall Street, during the debacle of these toxic derivatives that were sold as legitimate investments, that the slogan was IBG, YBG, I'll be gone, you'll be gone.
Right.
So these guys knew they were operating in secrecy, and they could get out of the way before anyone knew what was going on. So transparency, and the third condition I mentioned is get out of the blame game, that we all can step up and realize that if everything is connected, then we're all implicated. We're whether it's in our silence or in our active participation in creating the concentration of power. So we've got to step up and find our voices.
All of this ties back to one of the other thought traps that you talk about, this notion that we hate rules somehow, that we are inherently individualistic, and anything that interferes with freedom is somehow counterproductive.
Yeah, I that is so deep in our public psyche here in the U.S., I believe, that myth that rules deny us freedom. And as I point out, you know, of course, in our lives, rules give our lives meaning, shape, connectedness, whether we're talking about, you know, the Ten Commandments or marriage vows or, you know, simply who's going to do the dishes. We all create rules that make sense to us, and we adopt rules that make sense to us. You know, we think, gosh, if there weren't rules every day, you know, we couldn't function at all. I couldn't get to work if there weren't rules of the road. You know, every game has rules. Making a bed, in a sense, has a rule. Rules are life. Nature is rules. So the question is that I try to flip this in my thought leap to help us remember that, in fact, it's not that rules are bad. It's that when we feel that we haven't had a voice in them and when the rules aren't fair, then that really does make us feel limited, and it does limit our lives. But I also talk about the kinds of rules that emerge when people feel they do have a voice and the rules make sense to them. I talk about one particular rule that has taken off in now dozens of countries and in some localities here in the U.S. that has made enormous difference for clean energy and for economically as well. And I think of it as the reward renewables law that started in Germany and has moved Germany to almost, it will be in a decade, 40% reliant on renewable energy for its electricity. It simply says, you know, if you're a householder and you put on a solar panel or put out a small windmill or whatever kind of renewable energy, it means you're guaranteed by this law that you will be paid for the energy that you produce at a certain price that will make your investment worthwhile. It's very simple, and people loved it. And so now 80% of the installations of renewable energy in Germany are all households that are stepping up and saying, "Oh yeah, this is great." And the cost of implementing this is shared across all households, and now almost 400,000 jobs. If you translate that into the U.S. population, that would be several million. So, you know, this is a win-win for everyone. It's changing a legislative framework, setting the rules so that we all can participate as producers of energy and know that it will make sense for us economically.
And finally, how does technology and our misconceptions about the disconnect between technology and nature fit into the overall equation?
Well, I think the first thought I have on that is that if we start with the premise back to the thought trap about we've hit the limits of a finite Earth, that if we hear that notion, that we think that, oh, well, we have to sort of go beyond nature because nature is not really doing it. You know, we've gone as far as nature will take us, which is completely, of course, absurd because we are actually wasting, as I said, more energy than we're using. And when it comes to food as well, we're wasting almost as much as we're eating. So we have not, certainly that's an absurd notion. But the idea in the book is that as we align, as we understand more and more about nature, that we can actually align our economies, including our technologies, so that they are so that there need not be waste and destruction built into them. And whether it's, you know, learning more from nature, biomimicry is the term of art, you know, where we understand how nature works and then we mimic some of that genius. And I talk about, you know, the zebra stripes in the book, about how scientists studying zebra stripes realized that it was the contrast between the light and the dark of the zebra stripe that helped keep the zebra cool. This is the micro micro air currents that occur. And so they took that concept to a building and were able to reduce the temperature problems of heating and cooling by using the same genius that nature used to cool off the zebra, you know. So I think it's not pro or con. My book, my whole frame of writing and thinking isn't for or against technology. It's actually going deeper and understanding technologies that align us with nature. I was just, for example, at an institute in New York that within 36 hours, can take 25,000 gallons of wastewater from the bathrooms and the kitchens and everything used in this institute. And within 36 hours, by passing it through microorganisms and plants, can turn it into purified water that goes back into the ground, into the aquifer, as clean water. So that's a technology that is beautifully aligned with nature, and there need not be waste. In fact, they told me never use the term wastewater because there is no such thing.
Frances Moore LePay, the book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Frances, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My great delight.
Thank you.
Thank you.